change your setting from all panelists to all panelists and attendees, or else only the three of us will see it. So if you'd like to say anything to your fellow attendees, make sure that you change that over. Aha, it's being done. Very good. And also go ahead and start asking questions in the Q&A box as soon as you think of them. So we are planning to have a Q&A, and we're going to get to as many questions as possible. So the time to start thinking of them is now. So welcome. I see more people coming in. That is great. I hope that you're having a good time so far this evening. Seattle, where's everybody from? Colorado. Boston, yes. I know it well.
Awesome. Look at that.
Bulgaria.
I love these things because there's always someone from like Norway or Sweden being like, hello. And it's like, oh, bless you.
It's 2 in the morning. Ah. Wonderful. And I think we'll give it like one more minute for people to come in. I'm just going to see if anybody is stuck, and then we will get going. All right, so far so good.
Wow. The questions are just coming in. This is awesome.
That's awesome.
Unfortunately, we can't answer the question, when will the book be delivered? because that's up to Amazon or whatever Indie ordered from. And Amazon's been having some issues. But
so anyone who's here ordered the book from us.
Great.
So we will be sending those out this week because we just got the book plates from Rebecca. And so they will get packed up and ready to go. All right, I think we're missing a few people, but they will arrive. So let us get going. So welcome everybody to tonight's event. Tonight we're featuring R.F. Kuang with Ken Liu discussing R.F. Kuang's The Burning God, the third book in the Poppy War trilogy. We are Brookline Booksmith. I'm Alex, I'm the events director for the store. If you're familiar with us, as I see a couple people from Brookline may be, welcome back. If it's the first time you're ever hearing about us, which is probably anyone who's from Bulgaria or the other side of the country, welcome. We are really, really happy to have you here as part of our community tonight. And we appreciate your support of the authors and an independent bookstore through your ticket purchase and through being here this evening. As I mentioned before, the chat and question box are both open. I'm really happy to see that we've already got some great questions in there. Keep submitting those. We're hoping to have a Q&A in the last 10 or 15 minutes. So keep submitting. We'll get to everybody that we can. And meanwhile, feel free to make use of the chat. Just remember to set your chat setting to all panelists and attendees, or you will be talking only to us. And probably the people on camera will not be answering those directly. So if you'd like to talk to each other, all panelists and attendees is the way to go. Please also note that Brookline Booksmith has a strict policy against abusive behavior and language, and at our discretion, any attendee can be removed from an event for partaking in such behavior. Tonight, I'm really happy to be welcoming back two authors whom we've had on stage before, who happen to be two authors that I would literally listen to all night. We won't make them talk all night, but if you're looking for writers whose conceptions of their work will make basically every wheel in your head turn, they're on screen with me now. The conversation tonight will be moderated by Ken Liu, whose work as an author and translator is technical and meticulous, and which catches you in the undertow of its emotional heft. It takes incredible talent to use one language to nudge open the doors of another, welcoming strangers into new worlds and the contexts that form their foundations. And it takes incredible talent to reinvent the universe in 20 pages or less. So it's a pleasure to have Ken back with us tonight, as he's someone who is entirely capable of both and is just an excellent conversation partner. R.F. Kuang has also graced our stage before. She was last with us as the moderator for SA Chakraborty's virtual launch of The Empire of Gold earlier this year. Based on the way she talked about the Poppy Wars books and their inevitable conclusion, and especially the agonizing hints she gave about this volume of the series, I admit I started daydreaming right away about possibly hosting Rebecca for her own launch of The Burning God. So I am absolutely over the moon to have her here tonight. Rebecca has managed to fit a few decades worth of work, I think, into a few years. She has an MPhil in Chinese Studies from Cambridge, an MSc in Contemporary Chinese Studies from Oxford, and is working towards her PhD in East Asian Languages and Literatures at Yale. She also has sprung fully formed in the sci-fi fantasy firmament. Her first book, The Poppy War, received an abundance of praise and was a Nebula nominee. And only 2 years later, we're welcoming the third novel in the series, received already with an even more enthusiastic amount of praise and delight both by both readers and critics. There are many things about these books that have set them apart and made them so beloved and attractive right out of the gate. Although they are difficult and dark and even brutal books, they're written with a true affection and attention to character. As historical fantasy built on the foundations of 20th century China, they draw from a history and cultural background that's infrequently represented in American speculative fiction publishing. And like all good fantasy rooted in history, the books are both transformative and reflective. Drama and magic and newness are enmeshed with a keen attention to both the forces and heart of the real world setting that she draws from. Like history, her work can be uncompromising, but also like history, it's threaded with the stories of people, complicated, beloved, doomed, and redeemed. It's a pleasure to have Rebecca and Ken here with us tonight to discuss The Burning God. So please give them your very best welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Alex, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you to the Book Line Booksmith for hosting us. So Rebecca, congratulations on book release day. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you. So how does it feel now that you've got your giant series finally done?
It feels very weird. And you know this, the book actually gets finished months and months before you actually get to celebrate launch day. So it was way back in March when I like did the final copy edits and sent it in and took a breath and thought like, I never have to touch that horrible project ever again. The mountain that I thought was too high to climb is behind me and I don't have to look at it anymore. So I've been wrestling with my thoughts about how to feel about this day and what it means and how I move on from it. Because there's also like not really a sense of closure because it's not a real launch. Because on a natural launch, I would go out and go to a bookstore and sign books and maybe, you know, party with friends, go out to dinner, et cetera. And there isn't that sense of closure or a momentous thing happening. And I don't think it's really sunk in either that I'm just done with the characters and that world. Like, I think right now I am grateful to be working on something else and kind of relieved to have a break from it. But it was also like only last week that I was still writing some extra scenes for the pre-order bonus. So it's weird and difficult. And yeah, I think what I'm grappling with right now is how to let go of something that dominated the last 5 years of my life, which is also something that you're very familiar with. So what's your experience been like working on a project that epic in scale that has taken so long to complete? And how do you think you've grown with the work and how has the work grown with you?
I can definitely relate. I mean, talk about long, you know, lead times for publishing. I think folks who are not in publishing sometimes don't realize this, but authors are done with their books long before they come out. I mean, for example, in my case, the two final books in the Dandelion Dynasty are actually done, but I don't think the third book is going to come out until next November. So I actually handed in the manuscript last August, so it's going to be 2+ years between when the manuscript is done versus when they come out. And I think people often are surprised to find out that's the case, but publishing is slow and some because of the pandemic, as you point out, book launches are being delayed and that's just part of it. You know, I spent over a decade with my series and I really do think I've changed a great deal as a writer. And the final book that I ended up writing is not the book I would have written back in the 10 years ago when I first started. And it's kind of a great pleasure to sort of watch yourself grow as a writer. Hopefully readers discover that. So what about you? You know, I know it took you, as you mentioned, 5 years to go from the start to this moment. How do you think you changed as a writer and how did that get reflected in the books? And in what ways did writing of the book change yourself as you know move through that process?
It's so hard to answer that question because it just feels like every part of my life over these last few years have been wrapped up with finishing this trilogy and my entry into publishing, like learning how everything works, learning how to write a novel, learning how contracts work, learning how to get a literary agent, etc. That was all wrapped up in this first trilogy, which I will now treat as training wheels for everything else I do the rest of my life. So I grew in every conceivable way. The first way was obviously I was a teenager when I started writing The Poppy War, and I'm not a teenager anymore. So my outlook on life and people and human interactions and what I value has changed a lot. I think I taught myself how to write when I wrote The Poppy War because I'd never published a short story before I wrote that novel. I'd never finished a short story or even thought that I could. I'd never taken a creative writing class. I sat down with it and learned as I went, which was true for the entire trilogy. I think I learned the most when I was writing the second book, because I think second books are the hardest to do in a trilogy because they have to sustain the overall story arc and have their own self-contained story arc and finish an arc from book one, but also start a new arc that ends in book three. So they have to carry four independent storylines, which is just the hardest to do of any of the three acts in a trilogy. And that was incredibly hard. And you add that to second book syndrome, which we all get by default of having to live up to the expectations created by the success of the first book, meant that I was really grasping for how to write and what writing technique was and what my unique voice was. And I figured that out in the process of writing that trilogy. And so, yeah, I think I really just learned how to finish a book and how to complete a book, how to go from a half-baked idea to something that was fully realized and strong and hefty at the end. And now that I'm working on my fourth book, like it still feels chaotic and difficult and impossible. And the end still doesn't seem like something that I can even conceive of, but it's just not as difficult anymore because I know there's a point at which I will get there where my thoughts will have developed and coalesced enough that a book is gonna come out of it. So that's good. I finally got a writing education. I think the last thing is that I also just grew a lot as a thinker, and I'd be interested in hearing how your thoughts on the Dandelion Dynasty changed also as you were writing it. But for me, so my thoughts on how I wanted to represent Chinese history and the questions about Chinese history that were interesting to me changed completely from finishing the first book to working on the third book. Because the first book was from the perspective of someone who had just started studying Chinese history and who had learned about the Rape of Nanjing for the first time and thought that Iris Chang's book on the Rape of Nanjing was basically, you know, the authoritative take on all there was to say about Nanjing, which is definitely not true. And now I have a much more complicated attitude towards historiography and the ways that historical trauma is represented and commemorated and retold and repurposed. So yeah, that's created a lot of questions for me on how I would have done things differently in the first book if I could, but I try not to let myself entertain that question too much because obviously there's nothing I can do about that.
Well, you know, that's actually one of the things I was interested in hearing your perspectives on, which is you came at the writing process very differently from me. I started out writing short fiction essentially before I moved on to writing giant epic fantasy, but you started right away telling an epic story. So I'm sort of interested in hearing about your thoughts on two things. One is the scope of it. You know, how does the scope of, because I know you write a lot of excellent short fiction now as well. So you sort of, you know, came to short fiction afterwards. How does the scope, you know, difference between a short story versus an epic fantasy change the way you approach the projects and how so? When you were, you know, you mentioned the process of learning to write as you were drafting the Poppy War. How did you make any decisions early on when you were Rebecca the Younger that later on as Rebecca the Wiser you were grateful for or thought, darn, you know, should have done things slightly differently? Because early decisions in the series often have an outsized impact later on. And I certainly know that from experience.
Well, as for the scope question, I think for me, it was less about scope and more about skill. I did not start out writing short stories, because I think short stories are a lot harder. I think it is incredibly difficult to take an argument and a kernel of an idea and do all the world building and all of the character work and everything that you need to do in a novel regardless, but do it in 6,000 words or less. So a novel suited my particular way of storytelling, which is getting to meander and getting to flesh out arguments by having a different character represent each side of that argument and having them, get into reiterative arguments about those issues and change their attitudes very slightly after, small plot events. And that's how I like to move. I like to carefully explore and consider all parts of the world and all parts of the historical argument I'm advancing. And I don't think you don't get the luxury to do that in a short story. You have to be incredibly efficient, and it's so hard. And so when I was at Odyssey, during the summer that I was writing the second book, Odyssey is primarily a short fiction writing workshop, and we had to write 6,000 words or less each week. I was really struggling with how to do that, and in the end, I gave up and just started turning in novel chapters instead, because I would do 3,000 words of world building and then not have any time left for the plot. I think I still haven't really gotten the hang of writing an independent short story. The short fiction that I have produced, which was for the anthology, The Book of Dragons, is a riff on the same origin myth that I already used for a character in the Poppy War. So I already had the rest of the iceberg fully developed. So it was easy to just do a tiny riff off of that. And the second was, the second short story that I published was a scene from Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, from the perspective of a character who dies within minutes of us meeting him on screen. So that was more like fan fiction for me. It felt less like I had to have a fully developed arc, because the audience already knows what happens. We've seen The Empire Strikes Back, so we don't need the fully contained story of Dax's backstory and his struggles within the resistance and his death. We just need to know that he died. So I'm still trying to figure that out. I would love your thoughts on how to effectively develop an argument.
That's such a fun project, though, the Star Wars one, because I did the first anthology, the one based on the first movie. So it is a huge amount of fun to write stories from another perspective, another point of view. And I totally know what you're talking about. It's so interesting to hear your experiences on this, because I have trouble now writing short fiction, a great deal of trouble, probably very similar to you. Kate Elliott used to tell me that, once you've gotten used to writing these massive epics, it's very hard to get yourself to write short again. And I often, I sometimes get asked to write short fiction, and I often feel like I don't know what I'm doing anymore, because it feels like it takes 20,000 words just to introduce the character. And then, at that point, the story actually starts. And I'm like, well, how can you possibly have enough room to tell a story? It just doesn't make any sense. But nonetheless, we figure out a way to do it. And then I do think you're right. I think it is a little bit harder, especially once you've been used to writing long, to go back to that kind of short fiction again, because it just feels like there's so much more to say and you haven't even said it. One of the things I wanted to go back to was your earlier point about how when you're writing something based on history, how you end up making use of that material and how you end up feeling about it. So the Danzong Dynasty is a little bit different from the Poppy War in that I was not primarily interested in the history of it. I was interested in the history of it in the same way that, say, George R. R. Martin was interested in the history of the Roses, the War of the Roses for A Song of Ice and Fire. The history really wasn't the point. I wanted to really try an interesting new experiment, which is when we're discussing the national myth of America, we're often trying to draw on classical allusions and European models. So for example, our founding fathers made a deliberate attempt to model themselves after Republican Rome and after classical Greece. So that's why we have these classical architecture, we have these classically derived names in the Federalist Papers, and this idea that somehow America is sort of a extension, a modern incarnation of a classical heritage. So the idea is somehow Western culture forms the backbone of America, and any other kind of fantastical tradition from elsewhere necessarily must be mere tributaries or outsiders. And I wanted to challenge that. So the Dandan Dynasty isn't so much about Chinese history. It really isn't. It's more about reimagining a national mythology for a country or a nation similar to the United States, but with an East Asian basis as the classical inspiration. So in some ways, sort of the story of America is reimagined when you use classical East Asia as the model rather than classical Greece and Rome. So it's slightly different in terms of what I was interested in, what I wanted to do. But what is sort of, I think, shared between the two series is the fact that I think both of us made a lot of choices and decisions on how do we write in English a fantasy that draws upon East Asian influences or ideas or traditions or what have you without taking on the white gaze, which is prevalent and sort of all pervasive really in English fantasy. And it's very difficult to write without being pulled in that direction. So I wanted to see if you have some tips and ideas you can share with those of us who are writers on how to go about it to decolonize fantasy, if you will.
Yeah, let me unpack that. Okay, so the first part that I'm going to respond to is not writing outside the white gaze, but rather what I'm trying to do with history. And I think I'm attempting a different project than you are. I think for me, the Poppy War Trilogy was an attempt to sort through a lot of the ethical issues that crop up a lot in college classes about modern Chinese history. So I think when we're learning about things like the Second Sino-Japanese War, the Chinese Civil War, right, Mao's Great Famine, the Cultural Revolution, etc., it can become easy to view all of these ethical issues in the abstract. So when we think about things like what impels people to violence, what impels people to turn on each other, what is the motivation for being a collaborationist, what creates the conditions for atrocities like the Nanjing Massacre, what creates the conditions for the chaos of the Cultural Revolution, why do people act the way they do? These classroom discussions are incredibly clinical, and they often boil down to things like, oh, well, people just went crazy. People were starving. People wanted to turn on each other. This horrible thing happened, and we don't really know why, and it was chaos and it was madness. But I think that is also a way of otherizing this history, right? To describe it as like, oh, these Chinese people are so violent and awful, and they did all these things to each other, and it was completely irrational. Irrationality is a word that comes up over and over again when we look at how behavior during the Cultural Revolution is described. And I'm not satisfied with that, because I think the line between
Rebecca, yeah, if I can just break in, I would actually argue that the idea of using irrationality to describe Chinese history is part of the colonizer's gaze. And I would say that that's been there from the beginning. If you read back to missionary writings about China and what, you know, around the beginning of the 20th century, beginning of the 19th century, really, what people were saying, Western writing about China, this trope that China is the same thing as madness, of irrationality, is all pervasive. It's always done that way. The West equals rationality. China equals irrationality. They are primitive, they're savages, they are crazy, they cannot be reasoned with. You see this in Jack London's writing actually quite a bit. And he was, you know, a notorious racist. And one of the things that I found particularly interesting was how Chinese intellectuals adapted this sort of narrative madness themselves. I mean, Lu Xun, you know, was very famous for talking about madness as a metaphor for Chinese culture. So anyway, what you say resonates with me a lot because I see it all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting that the conversations now are that the madman was actually the rational one living in an irrational society. And I have some frustrations about using madness as like a catch-all term for sexy, argumentation, when actually I think it's really difficult to scale up from individual madness to societal madness. But getting aside from the point, so the popular trilogy was an exercise for me in empathy and in trying to see from the perspective of all of the different agents involved, all the interests involved, trying to look from the perspective of a Japanese soldier in Nanjing in 1937, or a communist cadre who's been ordered to go into a village and start beating up villagers, etc., and to see like why those actions make sense from the perspectives of the people who are living it, to try to understand the momentous changes that my parents and grandparents lived through. And it's just created more questions than answers. I think by the end of The Burning God, I got really lost in how I felt about communist historiography, about the potential for different futures for China if this Chinese Civil War had gone a different way. But I mean, from like an academic perspective, like creating more questions just means that you've unraveled the knot a little bit and opened up further territory. So I feel okay with that. But the way it relates to your second question on how to write outside the white gaze is, I think my training in history classes and conversations about historiography, there was an edited volume about the historiography of the Nanjing Massacre that was particularly eye-opening for me. And I think it's edited by Joshua Fogel, that really showed, right, like how many different ways you can talk about something that you'd think could only be described in black and white, which is a historical massacre, the death of perhaps 300,000 people. And it was wild to me to see the ways it's been internalized, for example, by Chinese diaspora or Chinese in the mainland or by Japanese civilians, and the different ways people talk about it to the extent that you're not sure what is history anymore and what is story. So with that in mind, right, like there's a big trap as a writer raised in the West to self-otherize and to write from the white gaze anyways, even if I'm not aware of that. And I think knowing how historiography works and knowing how history can be misinterpreted gave me a guard against writing exactly that sort of story, which is history, because they're all the same thing in the end. I mean, what was your approach?
You know, that's wow. It's just so interesting and moving to hear your experience with it, because I went through something very similar when I was writing the Danlan Dynasty, which, you know, as I mentioned, is very different in its project, but rather in when I wrote The Man Who Ended History, which is a novella I wrote basically around the time when I was in law school. So my particular thoughts about historiography and history, many of them, what you just said, you know, I echo them very much, because I went through something very similar thinking about these issues. And as you point out, a lot of times the complexity of it is you delve deeper and deeper into these issues, and then you realize that history is not really just about that moment, and it's not about even different perspectives from that moment. It's actually about all the layers of all the generations that dates back on it, on all the layers that are put upon it. History is never actually history. It's always the present. I mean, you know, that's actually a truism, and it just is always true. And I struggled a lot with how do I make use of this sort of historical trauma in a way that isn't doing violence to the victims one more time, which often can be the case when you're basing material on history. And I'm sure you had to go through the same sort of ethical considerations when you're writing about generations of trauma. I will say that, you know, for me, because the project of the Danlan Dynasty was very different, I had to work through a different set of problems that are related to the problems we just discussed, but are still somewhat separate. One of the great issues is, you know, when you look East Asian and you're writing fantasy that is based on East Asian tropes, in this country, the tendency is to pigeonhole you and call you an Asian fantasy writer. So The Grace of Kings always gets called Asian fantasy, which just amazes me, because it really is about the story of America. You know, that's sort of the point of it. You know, you don't sort of hear Song of Ice and Fire being described as, you know, UK fantasy or England fantasy or whatever it is, but there's something weird about the way we discuss writers of Asian descent who happen to draw on Asian traditions to tell a fantasy that ultimately is actually about America, and it's about the core of the American experience. So I had to struggle very hard not to, like you say, to self-otherize, but rather to insist that I'm in the center of it, that this is a story about the core of what it means to have a national mythology like America's, and what it means to have a national epic. And it's not an easy project, because what I'm doing is so strange, I guess, in some sense. It's very hard for me to get readers to see it that way, but it's really wonderful when readers do get it and they see what I'm doing. And I'm sure you have the same experience, because what you're doing is so nuanced and complicated. And I'm sure you've had readers who did not understand what you were doing. But when you do have the readers who do get it, you know, it's just amazing. So what I wanted to do is to turn the conversation a little bit lighter. And I wanted to ask you, what's the one small thing that you did in this third book, The Burning God, that really made you super happy whenever you think about it? You know, for me, it's these self-teaching learning machines that I, fantasy machines that I built in the third book. They're based on, you know, Han Dynasty pattern looms, and they just totally tickled my computer science background. So I just love the idea of imagining these bamboo and silk machines that are essentially programmable computers, and thinking about how to make that work. I could spend hours just working out how you write programs for these things, and then how you make them play video games, or the equivalent of video games. And I just spent hours thinking about how to do it, even though for most readers, I'm sure they don't really matter that much. But to me, they bring a lot of joy. Is there anything small, pleasurable like that for you in the third book?
Yeah, there's one scene that I really love, which is a little bit of a spoiler, so I'll try to keep it vague and not reveal who dies right after it. But I've always been really interested in how it's possible for enemy soldiers to shoot at each other during the day, but then not really hold any grudge towards each other. I remember learning about something called maybe the Christmas Eve armistice during one of the World Wars, where basically on Christmas Eve, the soldiers laid down their arms and shared a dinner together and stopped trying to kill each other for one night. And even between people who do have a personal reason to want to harm each other, if there's a history there, right, there can also be love there. There's a relationship. And I think it's possible to be at war with someone and also deeply want to be at peace and to just spend a moment together where, you know, everything that you stand for, everything that you're fighting for, just fades away. So there's a moment like that, 3/4 of the way through The Burning God, where the three central characters are sitting in a graveyard, and it's Qingmingjie, or the version of Qingmingjie in this universe, and they're talking about ghosts, and they're talking about what they would say to the dead. And I think that's the prettiest scene I've ever written. It makes me cry to read over it and think about it, because like there's so much pain in that scene, and they all clearly so badly wish that they could stop fighting, but because of historical forces outside of their control, they can't. And yeah, I just think it's a place where I did really good writing, and I'm proud of it.
That's awesome. I totally get it too, because your books are about these massive epic historical forces unleashed, and they're always so much darkness, but then to have this moment when people can just be individuals and to really come together and feel that, I totally get it. That's lovely. So one more I wanted to talk about. So we only have about 10 minutes before we delve into reader questions. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on this. Who are some East Asian fantasy books or writers who you consider powerful influences on your own writing?
Well, you, obviously, and Fonda Lee, but actually, so I've been thinking recently, one East Asian or Chinese American writer that I really admire, not for like the obvious reasons, is Ted Chiang. And the obvious reasons are that his work is brilliant and amazing, and he's incredibly smart. But as I've been thinking more about what it means to be a Chinese American writer and how we so easily get pigeonholed into writing about ourselves, our race, our autobiographical experiences, it just seems like Ted has always been untethered by all of that baggage. I gave a lecture recently on Asian American speculative fiction, and I made the joke that if his name were Ted Christopher, I don't think that anyone would suspect that what he was writing would suspect that he was not a white writer. And I'd like to reach that point, right, where my stories can just be considered universal, where I can be read as writing about the human condition or about a history that is not my own or about issues that aren't necessarily about Chinese history or Chinese identity or the difficulties of being Chinese American and not being read according to my identity. So I think Ted's doing that really well.
Although, do you think that's something that necessarily can be done by the reader, or does it by the writer, or does it require a larger change in the way stories by Chinese American or Asian American writers are interpreted? What I mean is that, you know, I think it's interesting to me that when I write a story like The Grace of Kings, it's treated as somehow Chinese or Asian rather than universal. And I don't really see why, if I happen to write white characters, it would be seen as somehow universal. I feel like the deeper issue there is that whiteness is seen as default and universal, and something else is not, rather than necessarily what I wish to write or not. What I mean is, you know, early on when I was starting my career, I made a conscious effort to not write about any Chinese American or Chinese characters, exactly under the theory that somehow that makes it easier to be interpreted as universal. And then later on, the longer I went down that way, the longer I realized that that seems to be avoiding the difficulties and taking the easy way out, and in fact, just perpetuates the problem. I think this is a complicated issue, and then all of us sort of have to struggle with it, because the way the diversity conversation in America, you know, is conducted, often there's this conscious or unconscious effort to keep people in their own what others assign them as their territory. There's this idea that if you are, you know, of Asian descent, you're not allowed to write outside of a certain line, and if you do, we're not going to treat it as universal. And yet, if you write within the lines, you are necessarily genericized as representatives of that particular group only, and you're still not treated as universal. It just seems to me like we're always caught in this trap where we're not allowed to do whatever we wish. In the same way that, you know, when I, so for example, you know, because I happen to do some translation work, people always bring that up. And I always wonder if I were white, whether people would, if I were white, people wouldn't, you sort of make the translation to such a big deal of it. I did it as a favor for friends. It's really not that big a deal, but people always bring it up in a way that I find very strange. And I keep on wondering, you know, just to what extent we always limit the way we talk about writers just because of the larger categories we pigeonhole them into, you know?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things at play here. I mean, so first, we obviously can't control how people are reading us and categorizing us. And I've seen papers arguing that you have to read Ted's fiction through a racialized lens anyways, because moving to the post-racial is inherently racial, which is an argument that I'm not super sure I agree with. On the other hand, I'm starting to see this with Chinese American writers around my age. I worry, right, that the fact that a lot of Chinese American writers seem to be writing about China and Chinese heritage limits them subconsciously, so that they start to think that the only way that they're going to sell is if they write about something that they have personal expertise in, and that thing being their race. So for example, when I finished the Popular Trilogy and we were talking about what project to do next, the conversation kept coming back to, right, like, what great Chinese myth or like what big new epic fantasy trilogy do you want to do that's about China, that's about Chinese history? And I So I wasn't, so I might do something like that in the future, but what I really wanted to do was a riff off of the Victorian coming of age story, right? I wanted to respond to the secret history with something set in 1830s Oxford, and it's not Chinese in form or in theme, and there's a half Chinese main character, but like he's not the most important part of the story. And it took a while for me to get comfortable with the idea of writing in the Victorian tradition, where tons of white writers writing in the Victorian tradition feel totally comfortable doing that, even though, you know, they obviously have no personal experience with what it's like to be alive in the 1830s, 1840s. And so that was a mental hurdle that I had to get over. And I think it's important to recognize that while it's wonderful that we're telling our own stories and representing our culture and writing about the Chinese diaspora, the Chinese historical experience, it is also important that we feel like we can write those universal stories that white writers are doing anyways, without feeling
I keep on going back to the point that when we're writing about the Chinese diaspora, they are universal stories. I think that's my point. I think like the fact that we keep on being forced to say that's not universal is itself a problem. I think they are universal stories. So I totally agree with everything you're saying here. I think one of the great difficulties I've had is, not my own inherent hurdle about writing what I want to do, but rather how do I get other people to view it the right way? Because fiction is always a collaborative effort. You cannot just write what you want. You require, there has to be a reader on the other side who will actually get what you're doing and interpret what you're writing the way where it would be interesting. I was talking to you earlier, I wrote The Grace of Kings and The Wild Storms and the entire Dandelion Dynasty as a riff on exactly what does it mean to create a new people out of diverse traditions. What does it mean to have a constitution? What does it mean to actually have a story and a set of institutions that we all rally around and make that into our core mythology? That's basically the story of America. But very few readers, with a few exceptionally perceptive readers, saw it that way. Almost all the readers who just sort of wanted to talk about the book as, commercial fiction, wanted to lean into this is Chinese mythology, this is Chinese history, which I'm sort of like, it's actually not. This is like no more Chinese history in the way that the Federalist Papers are Roman history. It's not. I mean, you may have people who are named Cincinnatus, but that's not the point. The point is that they're drawing on the mythology to tell a new story, which is what I was doing, but folks were not seeing it as the universal. So I think the only part I would push back on you is, I would say that the fact that many of us feel the pressure to write white characters in order to feel universal is itself a deep problem. And that is not something that only we can solve just by writing white characters. The more we do that, in some sense, the more we're giving in to this prejudice. That's how I think, that's the one part I would push back a little bit on.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And we don't have time now for this larger conversation, but there is the whole issue of market pressures and, like what it means to sacrifice creative freedom and creative vision to what's going to sell. And because like, as much as it would be wonderful to cast aside the white gaze entirely and think like, no, I'm writing a story that I know is a universal experience and people ought to respond to it, that doesn't mean that people are going to respond to it.
Exactly.
And buy the book.
Exactly. Oh, I know that's the thing we have to struggle with. But the one positive thing is you've gotten to this point where your series is wildly loved. People just are going crazy about it, and I'm so happy for you. What is next for you? That's what I want to know. So no more giant epic fantasy for a while, right? So is your standalone the Victorian era project you're just talking about? Okay.
Yeah, done with trilogies for a while, done with epic fantasy for a while. The next book, which I actually managed to write 1,000 words of today in order to get my head away from all the launch day madness, is set in 1830s Oxford, and it's a Victorian coming of age story, but it's also about student revolutions and the colonialist histories of universities like Cambridge and Oxford and Harvard, Yale, Princeton, etc. Because like when we talk about dark academia, we always think the dark part is this unseen a hidden force that's the supernatural, some kind of monster, some kind of plot within the university. But we never think of the university as being dark itself. So this is an interrogation of the structures that a lot of the elite universities that we belong to, that we attend, are built on. I read an incredible book a couple months ago called Ebony and Ivory, which is about the history of slavery and its relationship to the American university. And it's not just that people were profiting off of slavery and using slaves to build these schools and the money raised by the slave trade to fund these endowments. It's that the alumni that were produced, right, were going then going on to work in the slave trade. It's that the faculty was producing knowledge that justified not just slavery, but colonialism, imperialism, racist biology, etc. And those are structures that remain in place today. And I haven't really read a dark academia novel that deals with that. So that's what's coming next.
Wow, that's probably the best pitch I've ever heard. That's gonna be awesome. Can't wait to have that out. So I think we're at the point where we should do some reader questions. Alex, if you're still, okay, there you are. Do you wanna step in and send some Rebecca's way?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a really great array of things. We have a couple questions about author influences, and you mentioned Ted Chiang, but let's see. Somebody specifically, Elizabeth, says, I have never read anything quite like this series. Are there any authors that you would cite as influences on style and story?
On style, it's difficult because I can't in good faith recommend Orson Scott Card, but I have to say that Ender's Game was really integral to my understanding and development of voice and pacing and stakes, particularly when you have really young characters who are thrust into positions of power, who suddenly have to save the world, and they're still really immature. And on a lot of levels, they haven't developed into the heroes and the mature decision makers that they need to be. So a better recommendation is N.K. Jemisin, and I read the fifth season right after I sold The Poppy War. So it had a really big influence on The Dragon Republic and The Burning God. And it was the first time in a while that I'd read contemporary epic fantasy, and realizing what you could do with fantasy, the kind of tropes that you could subvert, like directions that you could take the story that were so different from what I understood as classical fantasy, were super eye-opening to me. So yeah, Jemisin and Orson Scott Card, two very, very different influences.
I like the direction that your influences are going in. It's quite good. So along those same lines, is there a standout book that you think has impacted your life overall? That's a question from Karina.
That's an impossible
good luck. Question.
I'm not going to answer that. I have nothing. All right. It's just that books, not that books don't impact me, but I read hundreds of books a year and I can't. I can't think of one.
All right, so Eduardo.
Oh, maybe The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon recently, because I'm thinking about colonialism, right, and violent resistance. And I mean, I've just been underlining every single page of that book, and it's helping me understand the theoretical basis for the Oxford novel. So that, I think that book is most important for both my academic and creative development right now.
That actually leads really nicely into the question I was going to read from Eduardo, which is, how has the process of writing novels influenced your academic research interests, if at all, from fellow academics in awe of your fiction accomplishments while in a grad program?
I think I'm actually a little embarrassed when people in my field mention my books. I hope my supervisor never reads them, because the first book is the work of someone who's very new to the field and dipping her toes into all of these really gnarly questions for the first time. So when I read that, one of the people that I was applying to work with had picked it up. I kind of thought mentally last fall, oh, I'm not going to get into that program. And I did not get into that program, so I think it had an influence. So I study modern Chinese literature and contemporary Chinese literature. So I think it helps having seen things from a writer's perspective, that I have a lot of sympathy towards the writer. I understand better what they're trying to do with works that even objectively from the outside, many years later, we think have failed. So there's a big, so like the dominating assumption about a lot of short fiction produced in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in China is that it's not good work. It's overly ideological, it's really didactic, there's just really basic moral messaging, and there's no sophistication in terms of character or plot or aesthetics or language. And having been a writer who tries to inject a lot of ideological messaging in my work, right? Like I have a lot more sympathy for those writers and what they were trying to do. And I think the important thing is not judging a writer on what they're not trying to accomplish. Like for those writers, right? Like really detailed like character work just didn't matter as much, right? Like it's really difficult to judge those stories by the standards of novels that are being produced in the 21st centuries because they're not concerned about the same things. And there's also a very different attitude towards the purpose of storytelling. In 1930s China, like the slogan was like fiction for the purpose of saving the nation. So it was supposed to be propaganda. It was supposed to be didactic and ideological. And I'm using propaganda in a neutral sense here because I think the political agenda behind a lot of these stories was very good. So yeah, I've lost myself. I don't know the argument I was trying to make, but basically I have a lot more sympathy towards writers and that shows when I'm writing about them.
Rebecca, I love what you said, being sympathetic to the writer. I just wish more of us as readers would also take that approach, period. Because I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, the idea that, you know, you can be subtle and go into all this sort of sophisticated aesthetic stuff that we prize so much. Well, it's largely because we are readers in a very privileged position. You know, when our concerns are very different, of course you can go ahead and do that. But again, if the writer was not interested in accomplishing these things, but had a very different goal in mind, then judging them on things they were not trying to do is sort of silly. You're not even in the same conversation. You know, why bother? It's and also, you know, I think one of the things you pointed out that I really love is the importance of recognizing that consciously injecting messages into your story is actually better than unconsciously reflecting prevailing biases. So many people out there claim that they're not writing ideological fiction. You know, it's again, it's sort of like a repeat of the conversation we just had earlier. So many writers out there are saying, my characters are all white, my story is universal. They don't even recognize the fact that they're actually replicating a very terrible white supremacist attitude in the way that they approach universality. But you know, I feel like if you're unconsciously replicating that, that's much worse than if you're just consciously trying to say something important. At least in the latter case, you know you're trying to make an argument. In the first case, you don't even realize that you're doing it.
Yeah, ideological fiction gets such a bad rap because we just automatically dismiss it as propaganda and not worth studying. But it's possible to be ideological and also to make something that's a really good work of art. It's really hard to do, but it's worth studying and thinking about. And this is a much longer conversation about how I think there's more to be said about socialist era Chinese fiction than we assume.
So talking a bit about the purpose of writing and the purpose behind individual works. Violet asks, in Rebecca's interview with the Fantasy Inn, she talked about how she was tired of stories for story's sake, similar to a topic Ken wrote about in a newsletter. Could you talk about that some more? And do you feel like writers have a responsibility to comment on society?
If I'm remembering the context right in which I said that, I think I was talking about my own inability to read for escapism, especially during a pandemic. And this is not like a value judgment on what stories are good and what stories are bad. But personally, I don't like stories that just distract me. I don't like stories that are just a fun romp through the woods where I can get out of my head for a second and not think about whatever is going on. During the election, if I'm concerned about the election, I will devour every single tweet and think piece and news article about the election. Right? Like during the George Floyd protests, all I wanted to do was read about anti-racism and anti-blackness in America. And so I just have this issue with not being able to look away. But I like that's not a prescription for how everybody should approach fiction or even their own storytelling. And there's a lot of value in, like, you know, just a simple story where two characters fall in love and have a happily ever after. And there's no other point than that this was a wonderful romance. It's just not the kind of story that I'm interested in writing or reading.
So I think
I'm interested in Ken's thoughts on that.
Yes.
God, that's such a hard question. I because I was trained as a lawyer, I pay a lot of attention to the whole idea of modes of rhetoric and what it is you're trying to accomplish with the modes of argument that you're engaged in. I think fiction is a very different mode of making an argument or trying to engage with the world than a persuasive essay is. So I treat them as very different things. And I do think there's something distinct about the way fiction makes the world tolerable, comprehensible, or as a way of understanding the world. And like you, I don't think I can do fantasy just for the sake of fantasy. As I was mentioning earlier, even when I'm writing epic fantasy, what I'm really thinking about is constitutionalism. You know, that's just the sort of thing that I think about. I can't really go to do fantasy for the sake of fantasy, whatever that means. I think readers know what to expect when they come into my work. I'm comfortable with what I write, and readers who come in know what it is I'm doing. So one of the things that I do is I almost always start out my stories or novels with something that I care a lot about, that I know some people really hate because they don't like to see their writers get political and get in their face about some of these things. And the reason I do that is I want to filter the readers out. I don't want to please every reader. I'm not interested in that. So I put the stuff that's most grating and difficult up front. So if you encounter that and you don't like it, you can go away and save both you and me some time. That's my approach to it.
I was really hoping I could ask this question from Cheryl, and I think Rebecca talking about looking directly at the things that trouble you most leads nicely into it. Cheryl says, so as someone who studies historical trauma and memory professionally, I could never hold the tragedy of Chinese history as a Chinese person, and I knew I could not study Chinese history despite pressure to do so. How do you deal with this? How do you get the perspective to study Chinese history when you are so intimately entwined?
That's a really difficult question for me, and also something that I'm still grappling with now after having written 3 books on the subject, because it's also an ethical issue of the fact that the reason why I'm able to write about these things is that I personally never experienced them. So obviously I wasn't alive during the Second Sino-Japanese War. I never had to think about if I was going to eat for the next few days, right? Like, my dad and I have a joke where the reason why I like eating yams and he hates eating yams is because when he was a kid, yams was all he had. And he can't stand the sight or the taste of them now, but I have yam privilege because for me, they were just like a fun root vegetable. And so I struggle a lot with the fact that, you know, I know these stories and they're from my family members. And I think I'm doing something right by chronicling them and thinking about them and telling people about them. But at the same time, right, like, I'm making more money than my grandparents ever did writing about horrible things that they experienced, right? Like, I get all the attention and the awards and praise, and it's founded on blood. And I still really don't know what to do with that. Like, what I try to do is write responsibly with a lot of careful consideration and research, and never portray this trauma for the sake of shock value or to make my writing more edgy or grimdark or cool, but to do it to advance an argument about how we look at trauma, how we look at pain, how we reinterpret it and manipulate it. But I mean, that doesn't really assuage the ickiness I feel constantly about the fact that I can only do this because I'm the lucky generation that never experienced any of that. I still really don't know what to do with that.
Well, we have come to the end of the hour, but I would love to ask maybe one or two more questions. I think we could start with Dan's, which I think grapples with some of this also, saying, do you think there is a distinct dark streak in Chinese stories and humor? This is something that he believes Rebecca mentioned last time she did a Booksmith event. But the Poppy War trilogy is, of course, very dark, and several of the stories in Ken's translation anthology, Broken Stars, are surprisingly dark. So do you have anything that you can speak to about that?
You want to tackle that supposed inherent darkness first, Ken?
Sure. I mean, I don't think so. I think human nature is very dark. So anytime anybody brings up some sort of inherently Chinese feature of it, I just, my instinctive response is no, because why do things that way? I guess my preference is to treat individuals as individuals and to recognize the universality of all human experience. If we start out by assuming that there's something inherently wrong about one thing or another, again, all we're doing is sort of excluding an aspect of our own natures and trying to otherize what is just part of human nature. The Cultural Revolution is no more unique or an aberration of human nature than the Holocaust was. And I think many writers and many thinkers have made the argument that the way we talk about Nazism is deeply problematic, because there's a way in which we talk about Nazism as though it can never happen here, and that somehow it is the Cultural Revolution and the Holocaust are aberrations. They're entirely unique to the societies they're in and the cultures they originated in, that somehow the rest of us are protected from it. And I think that's a deeply dangerous way of looking at things. I certainly have never found any aspect of the stories that I translated that are in any way, shape, or form unique to China. The sort of cruelties and horrors being committed are universal. And in fact, oftentimes they're inspired by the very kind of ugliness that we see in our own Western history. So yeah, no, I don't really think there's anything uniquely dark about Chinese history. It's just all part of human nature.
I agree with that. There's a really good passage in Lisa Lau's Immigrant Acts where she's talking about Chinese immigrant fiction and quoting a woman who says something to the effect of, I couldn't sort out what parts of this experience were about being a woman, about being an immigrant, about being a worker in San Francisco or wherever, and what parts of it were about being Chinese. And I think that's a good lens to take towards, particular traumas that we racialize and maybe should not racialize. Alex, you're muted.
Yes, I'm unmuted. These are all such good answers. I would love to leave us off with a little bit more about your work. So I guess if there's one thing more you want to tell us about how your next project is going and what we can look forward to. I really don't like having to veer off into that. Like, I would honestly, as I said at the beginning, I would love to just like listen to you guys talk all night, but I won't do that to you. If you have anything you can share about that project, that would be incredible.
Alex, can I actually just interject? Rebecca, I want you to answer Alex's question, but also say a little more, which is, what's the one thing about the Poppy War series that you wish other people asked you, but
oh yeah, that's
they don't? Great.
Well, this is spoiler territory, but I really wish more people who had read The Burning God asked me my opinions on the ending, and which is basically asking me, what do I wish had come out of the Chinese Civil War? But I can't say more than that without getting into tricky political territory and spoiling the book. But as for what's coming next, obviously there's the Victorian dark academia novel. There is also the Nudja pre-order bonus scene that I Have Been Promised is supposed to drop tonight, and that's a collection of a couple scenes from a certain terrible character's point of view that was promised to people who had submitted proof of purchase for pre-ordering. So I really hope that goes out to inboxes soon, and I'm excited to see the reaction to that and whether reading those scenes from Nilja's perspective helps make sense of some of the more atrocious things that he does during the books. What's happening next for you, Ken?
You know, I'm wrapping up my Dan Dan Dynasty series. I mean, I say this, but you know how it is. I turned in the book last year. It's not even going to come out till next year. So in between, there's copy edits and all that stuff to deal with. Meanwhile, I'm working on a bunch of short fiction because, like you, I feel like I need a break. I mean, writing on one series over, whether it's 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, it's just a lot. It's a lot. And I have to take a breather from it. And like you, I do not want to do another trilogy for the foreseeable future for me, really. I'm never going to say never, but I feel like I've gotten the idea of delving deeply into a world for 10 years thing out of my system. And I may want to do something different, much shorter and self-contained for a while before I go back into that.
Oh, on the subject of writing short stories, I claimed earlier that I'm bad at them and I don't have short story sized ideas, but I figured out a workaround to this, which is that I don't have Ted Chiang's scientific or philosophical mind, but my boyfriend, who loves Ted's fiction, studies ethics and is thinking about these short story sized ethical dilemmas all the time. So we've developed a scheme where we're gonna co-authoring short stories. And I have no time to write it, but I want to. But we thought about a short story where there's a technology where your pets can communicate with you in a very rudimentary fashion, just to express basic emotions like hungry, sad, like angry, upset, etc., and how that might change the ethics around pet ownership and how we view our bonds with animals. So I might be veering into sci-fi short fiction soon.
I don't know. I feel like if you start writing that, it's going to turn into a novel. And before you know it, it might become a series. I think these ideas have the thing that I have to warn you is, once you've done these epic fantasies for a while, you start to have a tendency of seeing every idea as potentially expandable that way. Anyway, just a warning for you.
We'll be careful. I am excited to try writing these shorter pieces, though. I think it'll be good. And it gives us absolutely something to talk about to get away from the boredom of being cooped up with each other all the time.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, and congratulations again on the release of The Burning God. It's going to be amazing. I think you have a bunch of events coming up, so you're going to be very busy for a while. And hopefully, you know, after the pandemic's over, we might be able to celebrate in person. So you get to have a second launch, if you will. So anyway, spread the word. Thank you to the Bookline Booksmith again for hosting us. And Rebecca, congrats and best of luck.
Well, thanks for making time to chat with me. And I will be a semi-Boston native soon, so maybe we can all do a reunion at Brookline Booksmith together a year from now or whenever they come out with vaccine. And I wanted to say thank you to everybody who showed up on a Tuesday night when you should be eating dinner to come chat with us, because, you know, this has really made my launch day, because obviously I can physically go out anywhere. So yeah, thank you, everyone. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Good night, everyone. Bye.